Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner. I'm your host, Trey Walsh, and today we have on the show Freddie New and Susie Ward from Bitcoin Policy UK. And keeping up with our string of interviews and recordings on Bitcoin mining, on regulation, we wanted to focus on the UK for our UK listeners that obviously has implications and relevance for around the world as well. So we spent a lot of time in this episode talking about current regulatory environment in the UK in terms of Bitcoin, energy topics. We talked about narratives and Susie's background in journalism, writing for Forbes, and the different narratives against Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining and things like that, and just how to find truth and source information and all of that stuff in this conversation. And it went to many wonderful places, I think, in this conversation. And I'm just immensely grateful for Freddie and Susie's contributions and work in Bitcoin. And again, we talked about, you know, investing in Bitcoin, your time and energy and kind of resources and research is really about doing the right thing and doing this because we believe in Bitcoin for human rights cases, for social justice, and doing the right thing as solutions for problems in our world. And that's why we're all into Bitcoin. So thank you again to Freddie and Susie for jumping on this. I really enjoyed this conversation. And I hope you all enjoy this conversation as well, especially our UK folks, focusing a bit on you as well, that are making up a larger and larger portion of our listeners. So thank you so much for listening. And as always, I'll also mention, please feel free to share this episode, like and subscribe wherever you're getting your podcast. And don't forget, if you listen on Fountain, you can support us and send us sats on Fountain. And 10% of that is going to go towards open source Bitcoin and freedom tech development through OpenSats and their Bitcoin development fund. So don't forget there, 10% of all proceeds through Fountain goes to support OpenSats. And as always, check out our sponsors and our promo links in the show notes to Saz Mining. We've got Bitbox and we've got Zeus for Lightning as well. So check out all those amazing products and discount deals in there. And you can support us on our Geyser Fund as well to donate directly to our cause to help us support the show, put out more episodes. We want to get this show on the road as well. And we really rely on you for support. So thank you so much for those that support and listen to our show. All right, I will let you get to the episode now. And as always, I'll mention, if you have any feedback or any questions for us, you can always reach out to me at hello@progressivebitcoiner.com. And we'll see you all again next week. Hey, Freddie. Hey, Susie. Welcome to the Progressive Bitcoiner. How are you both doing?
Great, thanks.
Very good, thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. Glad to have you on. Excited to have you on. For folks listening, we were doing quite a bit of chatting on how to frame this conversation before the episode kicked off. And one of the things that I've been focusing on a lot, and listeners will know this, is, you know, this regulatory landscape of Bitcoin. Because one of the things that I care most about is that Bitcoin realize its full potential in terms of access and usability and peer-to-peer transactions, medium of exchange, store of value, all of these things we talk about within Bitcoin that are deeply, deeply important, human rights use cases, all of this that we try to focus on quite a bit. And you all are deeply involved with that in the UK. So excited to have this chat with you and for our UK listeners that are making up more and more of our demographic. You know, this show is definitely for you, but I think there's ramifications for anyone listening to this show. But before we jump into the conversation, Freddie and Susie, for those that don't know you, you know, Susie, you've been writing more with Forbes, and both of you are involved with, you know, Bitcoin Policy UK, but just provide a little bit of an introduction and what you do and what you focus on. And Susie, we can start with you.
Okay, so primarily I do write for Forbes. I try and speak to as many Bitcoiners as I can to try and highlight all the amazing work that they're doing, especially focusing on Bitcoin mining, which is also part of my Bitcoin Policy UK work, as I'm the head of mining and sustainability. So I have a very keen interest in the environmental side and the mining side. And really my focus is just to highlight as many amazing people as I can and the work that they're doing. I was actually speaking to my husband earlier. I've just come back from the Bitcoin Film Fest in Warsaw, and Dirty Coin won Best Movie, and it was so well deserved. And it was absolutely brilliant. But a lot of the people that did that, they organized that festival for free. Everybody works for free in this industry, most people, because it's really, really difficult. And I don't think a lot of people understand that. Freddie and I work for BP UK, and all the work that we do is for free. So if I can highlight the work that people are doing just by writing about it, I feel that I just have a duty to speak to as many people as possible and share their stories.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think, you know, I've seen your articles popping up more and more and more throughout the ecosystem. And I think it's well deserved, all the things that you put out. I know the community is, you know, eternally grateful for all of that, and that will pay off. Freddie, over to you. I know some people, you know, you've kind of been around this space for a while now. I know you're recently on What Bitcoin Did as well with Peter, which I highly encourage folks to listen to that conversation as well. But I'm going to give a little intro to you for our audience.
So yeah, I'm a lawyer by training, and I've been in the Bitcoin space for a while, initially quite anonymous, and became more active as a result of my work for a fintech company. I started off doing more submissions to Parliament, to Treasury, to HMRC in the UK. That's our tax branch, if anyone's not familiar with that. And over the course of time, it became clear that while there was a lot of support for advocacy and lobbying in the crypto space, there wasn't so much in the Bitcoin-only space. And Susie and a number of other UK Bitcoiners, myself included, we're all attendees at a conference in Edinburgh, which some of your listeners may remember or have heard of. And after that, a few of us got together and decided to try and create an organization to emulate in some way what BPI are doing in the United States. And that is Bitcoin Policy UK.
Yeah, that's great. And now that you touched on Bitcoin Policy UK, can you give the audience a little insight into what Bitcoin Policy UK is? Many folks would be familiar with, the BPI in the US. So what is the main mission and kind of the values of Bitcoin Policy UK?
So the mission statement of the organization really sits on top of all of our other activities. And our key mission is that we want everyone in the UK, and obviously worldwide as well, to have the opportunity to use and to save in a secure digital money that can't be manipulated or stopped or diluted by governments and central banks. And that really sits behind everything else that we do. Everything else that we do really splits into sort of three main areas, one being advocate for good policy in the UK. That's kind of my wheelhouse. Susie heads up the mining and sustainability side. And then we have another team that works on what we call Next Gen, which is really trying to educate younger people in what Bitcoin is, how it works, and how eventually you might get a career in it. There's a lot of crossover, however, between what I do and what Susie does, not least because almost every politician and regulator in the UK is blissfully unaware of how useful Bitcoin mining can be in terms of things like demand response or flexible load or reducing methane emissions. The default position of a UK politician is that Bitcoin's energy use is bad. And in fairness to them, it wasn't obvious to me that Bitcoin mining was a net benefit to the environment until I started spending a lot more time reading about it, as I'm sure both of you have experienced as well. So maybe a little bit on the policy side before we pass over to Susie on environment. The policy piece is sort of, again, split into three main thrusts. The first one is protecting self-custody. That's absolutely paramount for us. The second is ensuring financial freedom in terms of access to banking facilities, access to exchanges, the ability to buy and sell freely in and out should you want to do so. And then the third is advocating for good tax and regulatory policies that will bring Bitcoin business to the UK and grow the economy in that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And to your point as well, for any, you know, new audiences that come in all fairness, something like Bitcoin mining is very counterintuitive initially. It sounds a bit, we have to be careful of this, I think, of Bitcoiners, and I think folks are doing a better job, but it can and does sound a bit greenwashy at first if you just say Bitcoin mining helps the environment and solves our climate crisis. So hearing statements like that, it can be some good marketing to kind of pull people in, but sometimes as well, you hear that and you're like, crypto, and then they just like Bitcoin and they just want to stack their bags and they want Bitcoin to win, right? But digging deeper and seeing, even just going into the little bit of detail that you did about methane mitigations, about load balancing, about these type of things, a lot of it is what is happening now and then what are the potentials, right? And we need regulators to learn about these things to get to the great potentials in any market. Susie, I'll pass it over to you in regards to mining for a moment. I'm curious as well, your background coming into this, what made you really interested in wanting to study and learn about Bitcoin mining and about the narratives around that and write some of the pieces that you have regarding Bitcoin mining and trying to flip those narratives on its head that so many of us Bitcoiners try to do on a daily basis, it seems, to fight this FUD wherever it comes from. But, you know, a little into your background on what made you so interested in this topic.
Really interesting, actually, because the person that really inspired me to publish one of my first environmental mining articles was Margot, because I saw her. I'd written some ideas. I'd been looking into it as an environmentalist. So I thought that I had to bring up my kids to save the planet. I thought that I was, you know, trying to prime them to do the right thing. And then one day my daughter just turned around and said, well, mummy, if you're so bothered, why don't you do it? And I thought, oh God, yeah, I'm not that old. I probably could do something before I die. So I just started liking and researching Bitcoin. It's one of those things where once you understand what you're looking at, you just become addicted and you just can't stop reading about it and you just devour information and then everything else just dissolves and all you're interested in is Bitcoin. And as an environmentalist, I really, really took an interest in that side of it. So I wrote the Bitcoin, how Bitcoin is saving the environment, the article that was published in City AM about a year ago, or just over a year ago. I don't know if you saw that. But
yes, a year ago. Wow. Yeah.
So I wrote that a year prior, but it was just an idea from things that I'd seen. I just had to write things down to process them because it was so interesting. And then I saw Margot's panel in Edinburgh with Obi and Mark from Skilling. And I realized that the people that I had been writing about as a this could happen were actually doing it. It was really happening. They were actually making the hypothetical that I wrote about, they were doing it in the real world. So I changed the article after watching that panel to from how Bitcoin could help the environment to how Bitcoin is helping the environment. So I started my career off as an accountant and then a financial analyst. So finance and money has always been a big part of what I've done. But I've always been concerned about the planet that we're going to leave our children. It is something. And like you've said before, you know, there is a problem. It's just the government overtake these things. They put a narrative on it. People get suspicious and then they start to disbelieve what the government's saying, even though there is some truth in it. So the other day I spoke to Nate Harmon from and wrote an article on OTEC and that technology and how they're using Bitcoin mining to create extra revenue streams to make the business sustainable, etc. He measures ocean temperatures. He hasn't got an agenda. He measures the temperatures and he said to me, it's warming too quickly for the ecosystems to catch up. And so when you speak to somebody who's actually on the front line and actually looking into it, you think, oh God, how do you get that message across when it's being hijacked by a government that just want to use it to further a different agenda? It's very frustrating. So that panel, my daughter being concerned about the environment, it all started to come together. And then I started to see that this was a way that I could actually make a difference. And so that's when I started writing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you have so many fantastic articles. What I'll at least do in the show notes is just kind of link to, I know, your Forbes page and others that people can dig around into. I mean, usually it almost seems like one or two a week just from that platform alone, much less other things that you do and, you know, Substack and things like that. Yeah, I think a lot of folks, once you kind of learn more and more, and talking with Margot and Troy, you know, at the time of this release, it'll be a couple of weeks ago. Talking with Margot and Troy and their motivation for getting into Bitcoin, I think mine as well, a lot of people are seeing, okay, there's a lot of problems and our typical solutions have not been working. It was not, we really like Bitcoin, let's make it work and let's take this round block into this square peg. It was like, no, this fits perfectly because these other ideas have not been working, right? The government, let's take it in a more left way, in a way, like many folks on the left think the government isn't doing enough, right? That solution, it just has not been working. Like Nate Harmon, like you mentioned, wow, the ocean temperatures, some new data coming out, suggests it's really bad. Like the ocean temperatures are warming quite dramatically, even for some climate scientists saying, wow, this is escalating quite quickly. So a lot of Bitcoiners, and in a lot of regards, but specifically the environment in this case, started looking into Bitcoin. And Daniel Batten was the same way, a skeptic coming in and then seeing it. Wow, this poses some interesting solutions in a world where our solutions aren't good enough right now. And I think flipping that on its head for people that don't know anything about Bitcoin or us Bitcoiners or anything like that, that's our motivation. I know that's the motivation of all of us on this call and most other people that I have on the show. We're motivated because we want to leave a better planet. We're motivated because we care about people. We care about our neighbors, our family, all of this stuff. That's why we got into Bitcoin, not the other way around, not getting into Bitcoin and then trying to make it work. And I think telling those stories the way that you are, Susie, the way that you both are, is doing really, really well. And I'm feeling really optimistic at this point with all of that.
Yeah, I think you can TLDR that by reflecting that Bitcoin enables you to do an awful lot of good in a very short period of time. And a lot of us initially came into Bitcoin either out of curiosity or because we were geeks, or in the being honest, in many cases because you thought, oh, I could make some money here. But the reason you stay is largely unconnected with those original reasons, particularly the number go up one, which the longer I stay in Bitcoin, the less interested I am in the price of Bitcoin, the more I care about its censorship resistance and whether we can continue to use it even in adversarial environments. Is Bitcoin robust enough to withstand a state-level attack? Those are the kind of things I care more and more about. And I think a lot of those obsessions come down to something quite simple, which, you know, which kids understand, which is fairness. And once you pinpoint the fact that our existing financial system, setting aside all of the environmental issues that we've just been talking about, once you pinpoint the consideration that our existing financial system is grotesquely unfair and is geared to exacerbating that unfairness in favor of a very small number of people with a very small skill set, then you kind of want to push back against that unfairness. And, you know, tracking back to the name of the pod that we were chatting about earlier, I don't necessarily think that's a conservative thing or a liberal thing or a progressive thing. Humans instinctively push back against unfairness. And you see this in small kids. One of the first things that you ever hear is, that's not fair. You have that innate sense of justice as a small kid. And I think it's a great shame that we lose that. There's a sort of a carapace that grows over that as you get older. And as soon as you begin to try and save money for a house or to look at the price of groceries in your shops, or, you know, realize that you're never going to be able to retire, you begin to realize that the system is not necessarily geared in your favor, and having an opportunity to do something about that is a good one.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I constantly think about too, you're talking about the podcast, really our kind of sub name is like Bitcoin for Humanity. We're focusing on so much on humanity, Bitcoin for everyone. I know there's the debate everyone versus anyone, but the message that, in my opinion, Bitcoin will be in every facet of life. It, for me, it's almost more of that timeline thing. I'd like for it to happen sooner rather than later, because I think more people will benefit in the work that you all are both doing. I want to stay focused in this conversation too, because I know there's so much that we can get into, and I want to make sure to jump into it, you know, right away. Is the state of policy in the UK? We've been talking about policy efforts in the EU, policy efforts in the US. It's been a little bit since we've covered specifically. I've shared some things on social media and possibly in the Substack, our Substack as well, but I want to talk with you all and maybe get a little bit of a TLDR on where things stand currently with policy efforts regarding Bitcoin, regarding you know, crypto, because a lot of policy efforts kind of take digital assets and lump them in together. We're obviously a Bitcoin-only show and speaking Bitcoin-only here, but a lot of the policy efforts include all of that. So I want to just get a pulse check on where things stand currently in the EU in terms of policy, where there may be some hopeful conversations that have been happening. What are your areas of concern right now for those topics that you were talking about, whether it's energy, environment, and Bitcoin mining, whether it's the ability to use it in a censorship-resistant way and have Bitcoin succeed as, you know, peer-to-peer, self-custody, all of that stuff. So anyway, just wanted to begin the conversation and a pulse check on policy.
Well, I know that he's the policy guy. Oh, sorry, I was going to say, but I wrote an article that you can put in the show notes. The same week that a spot ETF was launched in America, the UK almost stopped people from buying Bitcoin in the UK, but the FCA did. And the juxtaposition between those two positions is crazy. And that's what Freddie's fighting against, is trying to get sensible regulation, because they just, and they did it just before a bull run as well. Well, I know, you know, but just before everything starts going through the roof, they cripple investors under the guise of let's protect them.
Yeah. And real quick too. So obviously a lot of the UK listeners will know some of these things, but a lot of our US listeners, just to frame it a little bit more. So in the US, we obviously have our, you know, House of Representatives, we have our Senate, we have executive orders, and we have the SEC. A lot of people focus on the SEC commodities structures and departments as well. For the UK, what in general is kind of the larger bodies that are overseeing these policies? For maybe our US listeners, I know some of this stuff, but for our US listeners who might not know any of the framework of the bodies that govern this, can you give a little insight into that, Freddie?
Let me break that down for you. So we've got a, much like the US, we have a large number of these different bodies. So just rattling through them. So HMRC is probably the easiest one. That stands for now His Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And that's equivalent broadly to the IRS of the United States. So they're the tax body. And there's some interesting tax policies that we should talk about that prevent the adoption of Bitcoin as a currency in the United Kingdom. There's the FCA. They're the Financial Conduct Authority, and they regulate the buying and selling of regulated instruments. They have shares, what can be offered to the public and what they can't. So the FCA are responsible for the restrictions that Susie mentioned, and I'll dig into those in a second as well. In terms of listed instruments, the UKLA is the UK Listing Authority, and they are, again, broadly similar to the SEC in the United States. We also have the Bank of England, who are the equivalent of to the Federal Reserve. And the Treasury, similar name in the United States, that's fine. And then our legislative body is Parliament. And much like the United States, our Parliament is split into two houses. We have the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which are broadly equivalent to the House of Representatives and the Senate. And then laws are actually made in a very similar way. So much like the US, a new bill needs to be passed both by the House of Commons and also by the House of Lords. And then our equivalent of a bill being signed by the president it receives royal assent. In the UK, funnily enough, even though we still have a king, royal assent is largely meaningless. I can't, off the top of my head, recall a single example of the monarch refusing to give royal assent to a bill which has been passed by both houses. So that in our situation is a rubber stamp, whereas the president could, in theory, refuse to sign a bill, I believe, even though it's gone through both houses of Congress. So maybe just pausing there, having rattled through each of those, shall I pick up on the tax point first? Because that's quite a self-contained.
I think that would be a good place to go.
Okay. So at the moment, Bitcoin and all other crypto assets in the United Kingdom are treated by HMRC, which you remember is the IRS equivalent, as capital assets. And so they're subject to capital gains tax, again, will be familiar to most of your listeners. And when any Bitcoin is spent, HMRC treats that as a disposal or a sale. And that's even if I go and buy coffee with Bitcoin, HMRC believes that I have disposed of that asset and therefore I need to pay either a capital gain or I'm in receipt of a capital loss. And that's a real stumbling block for us in terms of adopting Bitcoin as a means of payment, a medium of exchange. There are other examples in other countries that we're pushing to HMRC, which would enable this, this step to be taken. Germany, for example, has got a very forward-thinking approach to this, which is that if you have held Bitcoin for longer than a period of, I believe it's a year, but I'll need to check the legislation, then it's no longer subject to capital gains tax. And the Lummis-Gillibrand bill in the United States sets a de minimis of, I think, $2,000 below which you can spend freely without the risk of capital gains tax. So that's very much one of the policies that we're pushing for. We wrote a paper about 18 months ago submitted it to HMRC, making those two points, the de minimis exemption or the holding period. And we've had recent conversations, haven't we, Susie, around refreshing that that attack and going back to HMRC on that. So, Susie, you mentioned that in the same week as the ETFs were launched, a new piece of regulation came in from the FCA. Now, this is I'll try and do this as quickly as I can, but it's relatively convoluted. So, in the UK, the FCA has a certain category of financial instruments which are called restricted mass market investments, and those are things that are not readily liquid. So, shares in a new startup, for example, would not be are not very liquid. Peer-to-peer loan arrangements, and they've decided to put cryptocurrencies in this bucket as well, which is completely daft. And this means that anyone wanting to sell them, like an exchange, needs to impose all kinds of restrictions on buyers. So like if Susie wants to go and buy from Coinbase now, I'm sure you wouldn't use Coinbase, but you know, let's use them as a familiar example. You have to categorize yourself as, what type of investor are you? Are you a high net worth? Are you sophisticated? Are you restricted? If you're restricted, you've got to promise only to buy £10,000 worth in a year. And then after you've done that, you need to do a whole questionnaire about what Bitcoin is, what other crypto assets are. In some respects, not such a bad thing. I've done a lot of them. We've put walkthroughs for a lot of the exchange questionnaires on our pinned tweet. And in some respects, I think if you can't answer those questions, you probably shouldn't be buying Bitcoin anyway. And then there's a cooling off period. If you're a new customer, you've got to wait 24 hours before you can buy any of these. So this was particularly galling for us because we'd spent a lot of time trying to educate the FCA as to why Bitcoin in particular is not a restricted mass market investment. Bitcoin's the biggest, most liquid, most widely traded asset in the space. And I think pinpointing the problem here, the FCA have got a policy which is called same risk, same regulation. So they have lumped all crypto assets into one bucket and they've stamped it with a big label saying massively risky. They have failed to differentiate between the different risk profiles of different assets within that bucket. Bitcoin has an entirely different risk profile from Flocky Inu or, I don't know, any of the other idiotic, or Dog with Hat. I mean, how on earth you can categorize Bitcoin and Dog with Hat in the same bucket? You've got to be a raving lunatic to do that. But, you know, that unfortunately is the position where we are in the UK. Susie, I've talked for quite a bit there, but have you got any?
But there was also, you're not allowed to have over 10% of your net worth in Bitcoin. And if you do, don't you have to?
But the
actual detail behind that means that you can't have more than 10%. And if you do, then you have to sell it and incur a capital gain.
And it's not that you have to sell it. You've got to remember that these things are box-ticking exercises, so therefore the exchange is to demonstrate compliance. So if you categorize yourself as a restricted investor, you then say, yeah, I promise I won't put more than 10%.
That's lying, though, doesn't it? To buy it, you have to tell a porcupine.
Not necessarily. You could categorize yourself as a high-net-worth investor, and then you can buy as much as you like.
But then that might not be true.
I couldn't possibly comment on... And I would never advise anyone to be untruthful.
But that's the point, though, isn't it? The choices are lie or buy.
Well, I think that's a great summary. You've hit on a really important point there, which is that the regulation is idiotic and very easy to circumvent. And, you know, I'm a lawyer. I believe in the rule of law, and I believe that good regulation should do what it says on the tin. This is not good regulation. It doesn't prevent people from buying the asset. You know, Trey could offer to buy Bitcoin for me right now across the Atlantic, and I could send it to him peer-to-peer, and they couldn't stop me from doing that. You can't do that with, you know, any of the other assets that they put in this restricted mass market investment bucket. I think it demonstrates a complete failure of the SEA to put the time in to understand the properties of the asset and what it is they're trying to regulate. You know, it's like trying to create a balloon out of a net and, you know, being confused as to why you can't inflate that net.
I think they've been reading too many BBC articles about it.
Sorry, Trey. We both went on a bit of a rant.
No, this was great, and this is exactly what I hoped for. And when I was sending over idea points, I'm like, you know, we're going to focus on a couple of these, and it's going to take a good amount of time. And I think you're saying very concisely what I would give in a very long-winded answer. And I think a huge part of it is, as simple as it sounds, is education. And I think the important thing to remember that I've talked about a lot on the show is regulators are people, and people follow narratives, as Susie will know, and writing the pieces that you do. And so in one regard, on my most bullish or hopeful days, I'm like, this is very silly. They don't even know what they're doing. Like, we'll be fine. The technology is very, again, it's like when they tried to control the internet forever ago. There's so many similar narratives. Same FUD with electricity, when electricity was found, you know, all of these things follow similar narratives because human beings are still human beings in a lot of this regard. So on my most hopeful days, I'm like, this is silly. They can't possibly really stop this. But in other regards, some of my concern is they start with these steps and they continue on. And if people allow this, regardless of you were in democracy, this and that, we've seen it in the US, especially since the Patriot Act in 2001. And ever since then, there's continues to be legislation that comes out. And Freddie, from a legal background, and we talked about the Constitution earlier, so many attacks on the Fourth Amendment that and First Amendment, again, outside of politics, but especially that progressives, I think, should care about. So many infringements there in the U.S., not to mention things in the U.K. There's different structures. These things can happen in democracies. It's not just authoritarian regimes because we, the people, allow it. So I'm a bit conflicted sometimes. I go between those two modes because in one sense, the technology in Bitcoin is doing what it's designed to do. It's really hard to attack it at this point in time and prevent you, Freddie, from sending it to me right now in this moment or whatever. And they can put in these questionnaires hoping people will be too afraid to quote unquote lie, right? Like you said. On the other end, I'm like, is this just the beginning? Are these kind of the testing grounds to see how far they can go? That's constantly what I ping back and forth between. And I'm curious both of your takes on that.
I'm not convinced we live in a democracy, really. I think it's just a facade of a democracy. And especially when you understand that lobby groups exist, that's just paying for influence. So when you look at the terrible narratives that come out and the awful journalism, and I will focus on the BBC because I'm going through something at the moment. Do you remember that article about how Bitcoin payments use a swimming pool worth of
the
water?
Pool. Mm-hmm.
So in the title, I think they said that each transaction, and in the main body, it said each payment. So even that's not even correct, as they're two different things. So even the writer didn't really understand what he was talking about. The source of that information, as we know, came from DeVries, and the reason why they didn't verify the information is because they trusted that source, which we now know is, well, we all know that that's not true. So I put in a Freedom of Information request to the BBC, which got refused. So then I took that to the ICO to raise an investigation, which luckily has been taken on. But I have been trying to contact the crypto journalists at the BBC. I've offered to help. I've said that I am in touch with researchers and scientists in the industry. Please, can you put me in touch with the journalist? Just completely shut down. And after that article was published, it then went and just 12 different outlets went and published the same nonsense. So if you've got this information that's out there and that's what people are listening or reading, that's just one subject. How else are they controlling people and what they think with misinformation? Because we can prove that they're doing it. So if they can pump out bad narratives, misinformation, they can be lobbied. We can be controlled through our phones. Algorithms can target you. How do we know what we're thinking? How do we know what we're voting for? And even when you do vote, how do we know that what they're saying they're going to do, they're going to do? They don't. So I'm not convinced we live in a democracy.
This episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner is brought to you by Zeus. Zeus is a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet for Android and iOS. The app features a built-in Lightning node that allows you to take full control of how you make payments on-chain and on Lightning. You can easily onboard to the Lightning network and let Zeus's Lightning service provider, Olympus, do all the heavy lifting for you. Or you can get more hands-on and curate your own Lightning channels with whoever you transact with most. Zeus has best-in-class privacy and allows you to have great peace of mind when sending and receiving Lightning payments. Not only does the Zeus team not want to know how you're using your money, money, but they're building things in a way that they can't know. There's also a first of its kind Lightning address that will allow you to receive payments 24/7 to your mobile wallet self-custodially. This is a great solution for a range of people, for those who just want to have the technical ability to set up their own infrastructure, to the nomads and dissidents that need to accept donations on the move. Other Lightning wallets don't give the users this level of control. In fact, many of them operate more like bank accounts that can be revoked and ultimately lead to you losing your money. With Zeus, you're in full control of your private keys and therefore can start to take full control of your financial destiny. Save 5% on LSP fees using code TPB in the access code under LSP settings. To learn more and to learn where to download, head to ZeusLN.com. Yeah, and that's the state of journalism, Susie. I think in general, you were touching on initially. It's that trend too. I think that can be a whole separate conversation. But just to touch on it, the past several years, I don't know how long. The UK press is just another beast entirely, I think, compared to even the US. But that not going to source verifiable information, like picking up, like obviously one of the biggest examples in the US we saw was the Wall Street Journal picking up on that debunked information about Hamas raising money through Bitcoin and completely conflating that 300-something%. And then Elizabeth Warren running with that to actually speaking in congressional testimony to pushing forward law and legislation proposal based on false information from a crypto source that even that source came out and said, hey, we didn't, you know, we messed up here. But that got put into the world.
And this was just 2 months after Hamas had asked people to stop giving them Bitcoin.
Correct.
Because it was too
traceable. It's a Black Mirror episode. Back to the UK. I mean, it really is at this point. But Freddie, I'll let you jump in on what Susie was saying.
That Hamas point was just so utterly ludicrous. I think an interesting point to pick up, though, on what you were both saying about difficulty of verifying sources. Just a few weeks ago, you may remember there was a big kerfuffle that the EU is going to ban unhosted wallets. And that absolutely ran around the globe.
You put out a lot of good information there, Freddie. I remember
Paddy Hansen and I
on X trying to correct people, which I appreciated. And I shared out something you had shared as well. But yeah, goes on that side as well.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for sharing that. It's the kind of rather dull point I was making, because I'm a dull lawyer, is just go and look at the source, read the actual legislation, and then understand what it means. So that piece of legislation, if you didn't read it carefully, yeah, you might think they're trying to ban unhosted wallets. But it was really an assault not on unhosted wallets, but an assault on privacy, which is concerning for different reasons. And the reason it's an assault on privacy is what they're trying to bring in. And if your listeners are familiar with the travel rule basically tries to understand where money is going globally and to collect data on senders and receivers of money. And they are trying to force the square peg of Bitcoin into the round hole of the travel rule. And they are beginning to understand, if you look at the legislation, that you can't stop transfers between peer-to-peer unhosted wallets, which in my view is a good thing. They finally realize that, okay, oh, I can't freeze Trey's Bitcoin if it's held in self-custody. So what they're trying to do is to have gatekeepers at the exchanges. So if you want to withdraw Bitcoin from Coinbase into your self-custody, I suspect this is going to come in worldwide, not just in the EU. You'll need to confirm that you own the address. You hold the keys to the address that you're sending it to. And then that address is doxed. And then, as we know, Bitcoin's privacy is imperfect. And then all subsequent addresses to which Bitcoin is sent from that first one will also be doxed. As we know, there are ways that you can improve your privacy in the way that you do use Bitcoin in self-custody. But you touched earlier, Trey, on some risks that you're worried about in that context. I think one of the key ones is, are we going to end up with clean Bitcoin and dirty Bitcoin? And which is going to be which? Is the Bitcoin in the ETFs going to remain fungible with Bitcoin that is held in self-custody? It should, because the protocol will treat that Bitcoin identically. The protocol doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care why you've transferred the Bitcoin. But I think it's prudent for us to do two things. Firstly, to oppose these laws and regulations as they're being brought in, and to fight them once they have been passed. They can always be changed in future. And secondly, to take care to prepare yourself for a world where you may have to demonstrate where you got your Bitcoin. If, for example, you wanted to sell it to, I don't know, put a down payment on a house at some point. Not that anyone else would ever sell Bitcoin. In fact, I don't own any, and I'm sure neither of you do either. If you ever wanted to sell it, be prepared to demonstrate what's called chain of custody. So if you can demonstrate that you, over the years, bought X amount of Bitcoin from Coinbase and you're now going to sell Y amount of Bitcoin, be prepared to demonstrate chain of custody, because that's the kind of imposition that is coming, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there's so much that you said there too. And I think the unfortunate reality right now, and I've talked to so many people about it recently, again, with Troy and Marga recently, is that, you know, Bitcoin is still so new. It's still, you know, we're just 15 years into this project. There's no guaranteed success, even of the greatest technological innovation ever. And how many people care about this topic that we're talking about? Not as many that I would like. That's the reality, right? There's a lot of, and again, we're talking like Bitcoin specifically, right? Because then there's even crypto, which not a lot of people care about that in general, right? I still have far too many people, regardless of ideology, right? They pay attention and see Bitcoin as like, okay, maybe the ETF or maybe the price comes along and they're like, oh, you know, Bitcoin price. They do not understand all of these other things we're talking about. Like, this is gibberish to them in large part. The different, you know, self-custody and sending it as payments. What are you talking about? I thought it was just like, I can have it on like Coinbase or Robinhood or, you know, in the US or other things and watch the price. Like, what are we on about with all this other stuff? And my fear, and sound a bit like Matt Odell, is that we look back, you know, 50 years and we're like, wow, how did we get here? Like, everything is surveilled. Everything is, and again, so many people would, I'd sound like a loon right now talking about this. And I would probably have called myself that a few years ago talking about this. But this is a matter of human rights in the world that we'd want to live in, and less about Bitcoin the thing in this moment. It's just that Bitcoin is probably one of the greatest tools to that end. That's my concern. And I will say, on your point, Freddie, with the EU and the privacy and dirty and clean, there was a new IRS template from the US for tax returns that just came out that they're kind of spitballing for returns possibly next year that would have some of that kind of more tracking elements to Bitcoin and kind of that connection between the self-hosted and the centralized, so that you'd have to dox your address. And I will say too, yeah, one of my growing concerns, and I would say is a real enemy to Bitcoin right now, are people that are only focusing on ETFs, only focusing on number go up, and not focusing on open source devs that can create privacy tools that the government cannot stop. So I am very, very bullish on all of these privacy tools that are coming out that are making it really hard for the government to actually implement and enforce these things. And then, so that's when you have a lot of these folks that are kind of talking and, you know, suggesting that, okay, you're creating rules that are unenforceable. The only way they're unenforceable is if we have really great tools that are attractive for people to use, that are easy to use, and that people want to use, that are privacy enforcing. So I'm a big believer in, for everyone listening, support open source dev work. That's important. It's not about changing the Bitcoin core code. It's about making sure that these tools are out there. That's a real enemy of Bitcoin right now. It's just focusing on this number element as well.
100%. I mean, return to what made cryptography so powerful in the beginning. So cryptography creates an asymmetric advantage in favor of the weaker party, the party that doesn't have the ability to project force. You know, you and I cannot command an army, but there is no way that an army can crack my private key using force. You can't use force to solve a maths problem. I forget who said that. It's not me. I should attribute that.
It's
not
Susie's
quote.
It's Susie's quote.
If we'll I actually could remember who said it.
No, it's not.
Okay. but yeah, that you Trey, you mentioned earlier the restrictions on the internet, and we remember Phil Zimmerman and the PGP case, and Adam Back and his famous T-shirt. I met Adam Back in Amsterdam. Actually, I fanboyed over him massively, but that's another story. But those, the original cypherpunks using cryptography to push back against the state and really push the state into a position where it's unable to use its overwhelming force to affect the lives of his people. And those are exactly the tools, those open source devs that you're talking about.
And now we know that Craig Wright is not Satoshi. He won't be going after the core devs anymore, which is great.
I was going to say one quick point, and I learned more about the UK and all these kind of libel lawsuits that again, not to sound, we were talking about old school republicanism and constitutional. In the US, it's a lot harder to do these things legally. I learned a lot about the EU and the UK specifically with the shenanigans and fuckery that Craig Wright was able to do through these court cases that in the US just would not fly and obviously it didn't fly ultimately in the UK, but it cost people a lot of time and money.
It took 5 weeks of that trial of going after forgery after forgery after forgery and calling in all these people. I sat in that trial and I listened to the cross-examination and I saw Craig Wright and the way that he answered questions, went round in circles, tried to confuse, talked absolute bollocks constantly. And then I listened, all the people like the Zcash guy, Zuko. And Adam Back and all those guys, they were all coming in on video link, having to testify, wasting their time, answering all this nonsense. And the lives that he has ruined. I sat next to Hodlenor while his evidence was being screened. I just couldn't get over the abuse that this guy had to suffer for the past 5 years at this man who's just using the legal system to ruin people that can't protect themselves. It's evil. And I was in the courtroom the day that the judge actually said the evidence is overwhelming. Craig Wright is not Satoshi, and he did not write the Bitcoin white paper. I remember saying to Freddie, actually, after Peter McCormack's case was finalized, I said to Freddie, can I now write Craig Wright is not Satoshi? And I hear him, and Freddie's like, maybe not. He does like to sue people. Wait till the COPA trial's over. And I'm like, okay then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had that article ready to go, didn't you? But yeah, Trey, I mean, to your point around constitutional protection, there's no strict constitutional right in the United Kingdom to freedom of speech. So that's why people tend to sue people in this jurisdiction for defamation. And also the burden of proof is the other way around over here. So the defendant needs to prove that someone didn't suffer harm by a false, an allegedly false statement, which is why the McCormack case is fascinating, actually, because technically he lost the case because the necessary constituent elements of the offence were satisfied, but because Craig Wright had conducted himself so poorly, damages were nominal at £1, which is just, I love judge. I've got a lot of time for judges. Susie, you're obviously rightly critical of our democratic processes in the UK, but our judicial system is brilliant and it's full of people with really, really wicked senses of humour. So I strongly recommend everyone, when Mellor's judgment is published, it's going to be a zinger. So do grab yourself a copy. And there are apparently some really biting, sarcastic comments in there. I can't wait.
He kept a straight face throughout, though. You couldn't tell. Even though it was obvious, he did not give anything away. It was quite remarkable.
Yeah, and I think, again, that goes to another point. So not only... I've talked about this recently, and some people would be vehemently against this statement, saying, you know, Bitcoin is going to win, Bitcoin is going to succeed, no one can stop it. There's so many ways on a technology scale, and my inner hope and what we're fighting for, I do believe that to be true, but it requires some action because we also live in a world of laws and governments and states. It is not, unless this anarchical utopia that some people fantasize about comes to be, right? It's not just technology. It's people groups, it's states, it's laws, it's government officials, these things. Why so many of us on this call, and you all in particular in the UK, are trying to work with these folks, right? So you have to tout this balance of speaking truth to power while also working with these folks. It's a very tough line to tout. It's a bit easier for me as a podcaster. I mean, it really depends. I've said it on here before too. Like I'm in the nonprofit world. I have some of these conversations. There are some things that I I would like to write and publish a bit more on certain things, but with my background and the different organizations I've worked for that are very politically connected, let's say to Warren's campaign and to Senator Warren, I can't necessarily put what I want to as an op-ed in the Boston Globe, even though it's sitting in my drafts right now. There's some things that I have to focus on and prioritize. I have a family that I have to make money. This podcast is not where I'm making money, folks. Just so you know. You both are doing different work besides the conversations that we're having here. All that to say, there are so many attack vectors for Bitcoin, and folks can and will get very creative, whether it's individual sociopaths like Craig Wright, whether it's government regulators, whether we live in democracies or not, as Susie suggests, what is it, right? There's so much money and politics in the US in particular, obviously, and lobbying efforts. So these conversations, not many are listening at this point, but we have to keep doing it. We have to keep going because no one else will. Like, if not us, who? And that's why I commend you both just for relentlessly daily doing what you're doing, because I'm sure sometimes, I don't want to say you might feel like thrown in the towel, but sometimes it's like, it feels overwhelming. It can feel like, what difference are we making when certain stupid rules come out? Like Susie, you were mentioning, like the day the ETFs drop here, then they're doing this. It's like, oh my gosh, what are we on about? What are we even doing here?
It's even harder because there's no money. And I know that a lot of people that do care about this, that came for the number go up and then the stage of the revolution, they're not getting paid. So it's hard. So it's hard and it's unpaid. How sustainable is that? But for somehow we just keep going because it's important and we're fueled by the sense of justice that Freddie alluded to at the beginning, where it's just not fair. And I think that that's what's driving a lot of people to give up their time to try and fix the money and fix the world.
On that sense of justice, I think it's really important to hold on to that because that's why a lot of us are still here, isn't it? Trey, was it your previous pod with... Troy was talking about, but Troy, when he was on with Margot, talking about the DC yep. event that BPI put on and how important it was to talk mm-hmm. to non-Bitcoiners. And Susie, that's a lot of what we do is actually talking to non-Bitcoiners. So we had actually in London, and you know, this was one of the things that made me hopeful for the space, despite all of the opposition that you've mentioned. We had a joint event with the Human Rights Foundation, and the audience for that was, you know, we deliberately targeted non-Bitcoiners or people who didn't like it or crypto people who might not understand the difference. And that was really showcasing a lot of the humanitarian aspects and the human rights side of Bitcoin. We had people from Alexei Navalny's foundation talking about how they had survived as an organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, by using Bitcoin. We had heard from Gridless talking about building out microgrids in Africa and bringing electricity to communities that wouldn't have it without Bitcoin mining. You know, we heard from Roya Mahoob talking about educating girls and women and paying teachers in Bitcoin in Afghanistan, where otherwise they wouldn't get educated. And we managed to get people from the Bank of England in the room listening to those presentations. And we had people from Crypto UK there who are subject to a huge wave of lobbying from crypto companies, Web3 rubbish. And it was really important for us to have those people there. But I'm delighted the Bank of England were there because the bank, in fairness to them, they're much more worried about stablecoins than they are about Bitcoin. But it was great that someone bothered to come and listen, because so much of the message that they get is, oh, it's a speculative asset, it's got no intrinsic value, it's not backed by anything. And then to sit in a room and realize, oh, wow, this NGO could not have survived without Bitcoin, or, girls are being taught mathematics and computer science under the Taliban regime, and their teachers are getting paid in this currency, and that it would not be possible with the modern banking system. I think Troy was right. So, we need to keep on, fun though it is chatting with Bitcoiners, we need to keep on reaching across the aisle and talking to people who don't care yet.
Mm. I know that my audience at Forbes are not Bitcoiners. I don't write for Bitcoiners. I know that every single page view, not every single one, the majority of them are not Bitcoiners. So that's also gaining reach outside of our little echo chamber, which it kind of can be some.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. Now, Bitbox is a hardware wallet that's open source, incredibly secure and easy to use, and it's what I'm using to safely secure my Bitcoin in cold storage. Now, I know self-custodying Bitcoin can really be intimidating, but Bitbox is designed for ease of use without compromising on security. It's USB-C compatible and allows you to easily back up and restore your private keys with a micro SD card, which is really cool. Now, you can purchase the Bitbox using the promo code TPB at the link found in the show notes for 5% off your purchase. And I really want to thank Bitbox for their support of the podcast, and I'm really excited about this new partnership. All right, I'll let you get back to the episode now.
Yeah, it's like our content. You know, we put out stuff on LinkedIn. We've seen some of our follower tick-ups go on LinkedIn recently. I hate TikTok. We have this podcast on TikTok because you never know who might see that or share it, right? Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So I share clips, two or three clips a week up on TikTok, just kind of throw them up there. You know, we're like, the reason I got into this, and I constantly ask myself, I'm like, you know, sometimes it was more earlier on, not as much anymore, because I think they've seen us stick around and they see what I'm on about. But early on when I was in Bitcoin, writing different things, started writing in 2022, when I started doing that, a lot of Bitcoiners were getting upset. Who's this progressive guy? He's a vegan. Oh my God. You know, all of this stuff, right?
Oh, I heard your pod with Peter. I love that.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Certain things, and I mean, huge shout out to Peter. When I first, you know, was jumping into this podcast and doing it, he was one of the first people I called and met with him, and I chatted. He gave me great advice on a lot of stuff. So anyway, you know, being in this, one of my goals, I'm like, I want to make content for non-Bitcoiners. I want to make content for my friends to hear about human rights. I mean, we did a universal basic income episode a few weeks ago with Scott Santons, who helped Andrew Yang kick off his universal basic income approach. A lot of Bitcoiners fainted at the thought of that. And Scott is not a Bitcoiner, but he was open to it. And he, Margo, and I had a really good and fascinating chat. And I wouldn't say that I agreed with more of it than I might have thought initially. So just doing content like that, just like flexing those muscles to show my belief that Bitcoin will eat the world and Bitcoin will be in every element. So it should be for everyone. That's who we're targeting, is everyone, anyone and everyone. And I, again, you know, going back and forth, right? There's some people that don't want to see Bitcoin succeed, but that's what we're here for. If we're just here for the fun Bitcoin conferences, then I don't know what to tell you. I think that's defeating the purpose.
I mean, what's the difference between a lefty and a progressive?
That's a great question. So one thing with the word progressive that I was alluding to with you all, progressivism, it used to be kind of the big tent party in a way. It was kind of the old verbiage in the US. It was kind of I think there's a lot of different folks that would come into that camp. And I've said this many times in the show, we won't endorse a political candidate. We don't endorse a political party. I'm registered as an independent personally. I'm not actually in any political party in the US in terms of that. It's a term that I feel conflicted with, that I still hold values in. But honestly, a lot of progressives and my friends, we care deeply about human rights. We care deeply about marginalized communities. We care deeply about the environment. There's a value set that I think a lot of us as quote unquote progressives hold. And I think sometimes progressive and lefty can be the same thing. Sometimes there's more libertarian progressives there. I mean, talk with Ben Ark, Ben DeWall. There's so many others that are in the libertarian socialism camp. There's so many different mind-bending ideologies within this camp, but I think a lot of it is underlying deep sense of community and taking care of others and people. And I wouldn't be into the most authoritarian, centralized government approach to this, but so wouldn't a lot of other progressives. A lot of other progressives just care about people at the end of the day. And I think they're ripe for hearing a different argument that is outside of, okay, we have to give the central government authority as much power as possible. I think if we tell them how Bitcoin can actually empower different communities, I'm still convinced, I'm still holding on, and people are like, oh my gosh, like AOC in the US, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the US, the representative, just hearing about Bitcoin for marginalized communities. I'm just waiting for the day when progressives understand that more, rather than thinking we have to wait for Biden to sign some sort of executive order to give us XYZ rights or to give us more financial security. That's not going to happen, folks. That's not happening.
Yeah, so for me, that's why, you know, the fairness argument is so powerful and so important. Interesting hearing you break down how different perspectives were there, because I think if Winston Churchill was around today, his views might be seen as more liberal or progressive than in the 50s. I mean, I don't know if you've heard the famous quotes about the welfare state. He said there should be a ladder up which everyone must be able to rise, but a net below which no one should fall. And so the whole idea of his approach to the welfare state was that no one should be prevented from succeeding as much as they're capable of succeeding, but we still need to help the people who may have failed to succeed. And it's hard to say that's either left or right. That, you know, that's just a natural human response. And as on the natural human response, you see this when people are acting without thinking. You know, when there's an accident, people run to help. You know, when someone's fallen over, people will go and help to pick them up. And this is something that humans do naturally. And, you know, if you're running to help someone who's fallen over or picking someone up who's fallen down a flight of stairs, you're not doing that from a left or a right or progressive or conservative perspective. You're just doing it because that's the right thing to do. And so much of, I think, what we're in the space for is because we feel this is the right thing to do with our time, and that we can improve outcomes that have not hitherto been improved by what we've tried so far.
Most people are good. Fundamentally, most people are good. And I think that was one of the biggest mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, was when she referred to Trump supporters as deplorables, because rather than listening to what their concerns were, she just wrote them off as bad people. And I just don't think that that's a good idea. I mean, they may have had a different solution than we would have to the problems that they have, but they absolutely should be listened to.
Yeah, and I think too, for a lot of our listeners, that it's mostly Bitcoiners I'm hearing from. A lot of other progressives I talk to, I was mentioning this before the show, you know, progressivism or progressives being aligned with the Democratic Party started to die and decline post 2012. And I think a lot of it happened when, you know, we saw that Obama is sending just as many, if not more, drones to the Middle East. A lot of progressives deeply are anti-war and anti-forever wars, right? Not to get into topics of justifiable wars, but gosh, the Iraq war and our missions in Afghanistan, almost unanimously agreement in the U.S. is that we really fucked that up pretty badly. So a lot of progressives were disenfranchised with Obama's message and then seeing innocent kids and women and children being murdered in the Middle East by our drones, right? And then you go into the 2016 election, where the Democratic National Convention and the DNC in general as the organization completely sabotaged Bernie's campaign with emails back and forth and really propping up and supporting Hillary and doing things in a very dirty and manipulative way. And then Hillary lost massively because of some of the tactics that you mentioned, and then the rise of Donald Trump. So progressives had long, long been disenfranchised with politics, with parties, with these structures, which is why my hope is that more and more folks will listen to something like this or many, many other content and read articles like yours, Susie, and others around the world, but especially in the US, because many progressives are disenfranchised with all of it. We're so disillusioned and removed from politics that we're looking for solutions. And last thing I'll say on that is a lot of folks, whether it's in climate activism and others, you've seen the mental health declines with youth. You've seen these activists, myself included, and Margo has talked about this from Occupy protests before, you know, the right instincts, the right ability at diagnosing problems, but not coming up with solutions that are actually making a difference. So I came to a complete point of almost hopelessness on the future in terms of our climate, in terms of our global financial system post the great financial crisis. Then I heard about Bitcoin. Then I heard from Alex Gladstein and heard the Trojan horse case. Then I heard from Farida and Togo Rights. Then I heard from so many other human rights activists. And I'm like, wow, we might have a fighting chance. Like, we might have a fighting chance now. And then I just didn't turn back. And I've just been obsessive on this and hoping to pull more people in, because there's a lot of people that are quite honestly miserable thinking about politics. I'm sure the same case in the UK and in the US. They're looking for answers. And I'm not saying Bitcoin solves everything, right? But it gets you thinking about the world in different ways. And the more people we get into Bitcoin, the more cool solutions that we're going to come up with, because there's going to be some folks coming in that think about something in a way that none of us on this call do, or none of a particular subset of Bitcoiners might, that are really cool solutions utilizing Bitcoin or thinking about the world in different ways. That's what I'm hopeful for. That's what keeps me going.
Yeah, I couldn't put it any better.
I love that. That's such a nice summary.
Speaking of hope.
I mean, maybe.
Because, you know, a lot of, I want to be mindful of this too. I think it's not that people have said it to me directly, but, you know, I try to talk about the regulatory concerns and be serious and real about them too. But obviously, we are all still here doing what we're doing. Bitcoiners are some of the most hopeful people because we see a future where others might not see a future. Others are like World War III, climate catastrophe, politicians and authoritarianism and all of this stuff. Bitcoiners, we're pretty hopeful.
Also very smart. And for a Ponzi scheme that's boiling the oceans, there's a surprising number of very, very intelligent people in the space.
I mean, I think all I'd add to that, Trey, I forget who said this. I realize I've spent the whole chat forgetting to who has said the various things I've quoted, but this one you may know. It's never underestimate the power of a small group of committed people to change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And I think you're right about Bitcoin being hopeful. And in some ways, you can communicate that hope even without mentioning the word Bitcoin. You know, if you focus on some of the issues we've talked about around, you know, financial unfairness, about the unaffordability of housing, about inflation and food prices, these are all conversations you can have with people without mentioning Bitcoin at all. And you could imagine another solution to them, but in my view, the best solution that the best potential solution we have is in the form of Bitcoin. And maybe we can mention that last, once you really identify what is making people depressed, what's causing this degree of hopelessness. Maybe whisper that in their ear while they're sleeping. And
I'm always surprised by how many people are Bitcoiners and they don't know it. When you have conversations and they have all the same concerns and they see all the same things that you do, yet they don't have it. It's a little bit like Douglas Adams, Freddie. They don't have the punchline.
Bitcoin. Oh, yeah.
Bitcoin is the punchline. That's the thing that they're looking for that plugs that gap. And they've got all the parts there, but they just haven't found Bitcoin yet.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I want to, maybe for the last few minutes here of this episode, you know, I want to focus on distinctly things in the UK. I think some of the challenges, you know, it's going to be a whole nother episode or whole, you know, everyone has their own individual experiences, of course, but trying to encapsulate, you know, the challenges in the UK right now, what are some real opportunities that you both from your experiences, personal or just thinking about the work that Bitcoin poses for folks in the UK right now? And how would you talk to someone, right? You talk about people identifying problems and being Bitcoiners and not knowing it. How would you talk to the average person? You're walking through London and someone's just like, what do I do? What hope is there in this world? How do you talk to someone about Bitcoin or about what you all are trying to do on so many fronts? What are the opportunities that Bitcoin poses? Because I'm a strongly believer if enough people see those opportunities, the regulators will follow in terms of folks are saying, no, I'm gonna hold my Bitcoin, thanks very much. And no, you don't need to know. It's not your you know, we're gonna expect better things from our companies and products and all of these things. Businesses are gonna start accepting Bitcoin more because it's a better store value and it's lower credit card fee. You know, it doesn't incur the same credit card fees over Lightning, things like that. So what are the ways you like to talk to people about Bitcoin and what it can do for someone in the UK?
I might say one thing in terms of the nature of money. So a lot of people obviously harp on about this a lot. A lot of people don't think that either the government prints money or the Bank of England does. Actually, the way that money is created in the modern economy is via lending. So when a bank creates a loan, it artificially creates money in your bank account, and then it books that sum as an asset in its own account. And this is one of the reasons that housing in the UK is so unaffordable, because if you have enough money to save up to get a deposit, then you can buy multiple houses, and then the bank creates multiple swathes of money and books those in its own accounts, and then it lends out more money because by having the asset in its accounts, it then reduces its leverage. And everyone in the UK is obsessed with housing, and it's unaffordable for virtually everyone. And understanding the link between rampant creation of new money by commercial banks and the house fire, to coin a phrase, of your own cash savings is quite a blunt point to make. And then it's only a little jump from there to say, well, maybe you want to have the opportunity to save your money in something that the government can't create more of. And, you know, for some people that could be gold. I'm not anti-gold particularly. I just think Bitcoin is better. But rather than saving your money in houses or in gold, you have an opportunity to save your money in a hard asset that they can't create more of, they can't stop or manipulate, and which is globally liquid and which you can take with you or send anywhere on the planet. So I think it's easy, as we all know, to go in very hard on these things, but, you know, planting seeds and talking about you know, an example of financial unfairness like that. Susie, do you want to jump in with something?
I think the more receptive somebody is to listening, the more pain they have felt. So unfortunately, in the UK, we are in a protected little bubble. The divide between the rich and the poor is obviously growing, like it is everywhere in the world. But when I speak to my hairdresser, she is really struggling. She feels like the system isn't working for her. The government is letting her down. She can see all the problems as clear as day. But if I go and speak to somebody who's just a middle-class professional living in, I don't know, a middle-class area, they're not going to listen because the system is working for them. So if the system has historically worked for them and still is kind of working for them, even though everything's a little bit more expensive, they're not receptive at all. So the only people that I really try and talk to are the ones that I know that are feeling the pain. Otherwise, there's just no point. They're just not receptive.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
If you look at the global adoption of Bitcoin, it tends to be much higher in places like Nigeria and Vietnam, for example. Trey, you mentioned an interesting point in terms of credit card payment fees. So this is another bugbear of mine. I used to work in PayTech, and people obviously don't understand how complicated it is when you tap your card on a point of sale terminal. That's what's called a four-party transaction. You have various different parties, a merchant acquirer, a card issuer, a correspondent bank at the end. And there are all kinds of messages that are sent through that system. And each of the parties in that four-party system takes a fee. And in some cases, you know, Amex is the most expensive, but Visa and MasterCard are not far behind. The merchant actually gets quite a lot less of the amount that you pay for whatever it is you're buying than you would expect as the customer. And so I think that's an interesting wedge issue that we will be exploring, the benefits to merchants of adopting Bitcoin, not necessarily for Susie and I as citizens here, but the percentage points that you can save on every transaction because you don't need to pay scheme issuer fees to Visa, to MasterCard or Amex. And obviously, as we know, Susie, if you start accepting Bitcoin, you get lots of crazy Bitcoiners turning up at your store wanting to buy stuff from you.
Yeah, it's not hard. That, I mean, Peter talked about it, and I you both may have been at it, but cheat code. You know, Peter McCormack, great marketing guru, but calling it cheat code for a reason. Like it is a cheat code, very practically, for folks, without even getting into all the other use cases. Take that one alone. For me, that's kind of worth it for people to look into.
Well, it supercharges businesses and it makes good business sense. So even if you're not into the humanitarian aspect or how it can help people or all the amazing things, if you just look at it from a capitalistic point of view, you know, it makes business sense. Bitcoin mining is making building out renewables a lot more feasible. It's helping giving additional revenue streams to companies that would otherwise fail. There are good business reasons why you would want to adopt Bitcoin.
You can be completely selfish and end up saving the world by accident.
And that's one thing that I came to realize in that bout of hopelessness about the world, as I was like, people are very greedy. Corporations are very greedy. Fossil fuel companies are very greedy and malicious. Well, Bitcoin can take advantage of that. And let's use the world as it is to create a better world. And they don't even realize it. Like that hack as well. I probably wouldn't even be here without realizing that hack pretty early on. Because too many folks assume these people are just going to do the right thing. They don't have to. They don't have to. That's what's brilliant about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the... I mean, the more you read and think philosophically about the Bitcoin system, the more you're just absolutely awestruck by the genius of Satoshi. You know, understanding human nature to the extent where you can incentivize people to act properly even by giving free rein to their worst impulses. the very system incentivizes you to do the right thing by the protocol, because it acknowledges what might otherwise be seen of as failings in your own nature. It's wonderful.
And the fact that it's easier to mine than hack it. So there's just absolutely, you might as well just get on board and be a part of it.
There's the wonderful quote about why would a nation state bother with a 51% attack?
Yeah, completely. You can't. You got to get on board. That's what's amazing with proof of work, at least. Now, in closing, because I'd like to just fly out there and have a sit down for several hours to keep discussing this. But from your work at Bitcoin Policy UK, whether you have specific proposals or kind of you think about it this way, what are the ways you would like to see policymakers adjust or be more progressive in their thinking about Bitcoin specifically? And maybe, Freddie, we can talk about some of the, you know, the tax code thing. You had mentioned that, the way that it works. Are there some specific kind of TLDR on different proposals or different ways you would want to handle it? You mentioned, you know, we already kind of mentioned the threshold of payments. Maybe that's a good start. Are there others that you want to mention? And maybe, Susie, what are the ways that the regulators or people can handle Bitcoin mining and energy? And like in the US, for instance, Biden would want to put a 30% tax on all miners. And Troy mentioned this greatly, regardless of whether they're mining renewably or on coal. It doesn't matter. Taxing it, which is absolutely asinine, I don't think that will actually see the light of day. It's important to mention. So are there ways that lawmakers in the UK can be more progressive with this? But Freddie, we can start with you.
Yeah, I'll be quick. So the tax treatment is important for use as a medium of exchange. And I think each of those two policy changes would be helpful. Firstly, the holding period, or secondly, a de minimis amount. And obviously that will result in some loss to the revenue of capital gains tax, but we would need to run the numbers and show that that will be offset by an increase in commerce and the resultant taxes that would come to the public purse as a result of that. So that I think is one useful thing that we should push for, and there'd be a lot of support for that. And the second is really in regulatory terms, and this is to your point about education, understanding that Bitcoin is not the same as all of these other cryptocurrencies. It's the same risk, same regulation is fine up to a point. But if the risks are not the same, then the regulation should not be the same. And so we're going to keep pushing on that point as well. I think that those are the two key ones for me.
So a lot of our energy regulations, they talk about how we can conserve energy, how we can use less energy. Most of the national grids discussions is around how we save and use less. But with AI and all the things, we know that we can't use less electricity. So right there, their basis is flawed. So we also know that there's a hell of a lot of curtailment that goes on with renewables over here. So much, millions and millions and millions. And that's costing the end user more money, and our energy prices are absolutely huge. And I was on a Twitter Spaces the other day, again with Argo, and they were saying that utility companies in the US are really starting to wake up to this. So I really hope that they will look to the US, realize that we've wake up and realize we're not going to be using less electricity. We are always going to be using more. And try and use the US as a bit of a template, because in Texas they're absolutely smashing it.
Yeah, they really are. And I my hope is that these practical folks, like we had mentioned before, the Bitcoin Policy Summit or other places like you all's event with HRF in London recently discussing, that you'll get people that are not ideologically driven or politicians looking to grandstand in a room. Some of these regulators, some of these bank officials, whoever. You don't need live stream cameras there, you know, whatever, sometimes yes, sometimes no, and just learn about these things. And then people realize, okay, these Bitcoiners, they're just coming up with solutions to some energy grid challenges, some human rights challenges, some fundraising challenges. Interesting. It's less about Bitcoiners wanting to overthrow the state tomorrow or something like that, right? It's more about practical solutions today that even if someone, call it whatever you want, Bitcoin, whatever, you know, it's Bitcoin. The thing is that tool, it is a tool. It's not an obsession over Bitcoin. It is an obsession over the tool and what it unlocks. And it continues to grow in adoption and all these things because it's been working, not because it is just a cult that no matter what the end product or a Ponzi scheme, right? It is a tool that's been working. That's why people keep showing up. and these regulators keep showing up. They might dismiss it. A recent case that I love is in Paraguay, right? Their Senate was looking to ban Bitcoin mining in Paraguay. Within a week or 2 weeks, someone can fact check me on this. It was a couple of weeks. They then completely flipped and were like, actually, we're going to look into selling our electricity, our excess hydropower, to these Bitcoin miners that are coming into Paraguay and re-examining our relationship with Brazil and how we're selling electricity. Now, people can look into that, whether geopolitically that's the right decision, but they went from saying Bitcoin mining bad, we're going to ban it. Them saying that caused a lot of people to probably send emails, phone calls, this and that. And then they started to learn because they legislated. They wanted to legislate without learning. Once they were educated, maybe a few hours, it took them to realize, oh my gosh, this unlocks great revenue for us in Paraguay. Again, senators with their, you know, different game theoretics here, they changed course real fast. So when I saw that, I'm like, oh yeah, we're still really early and this is going to happen everywhere.
Because it makes business sense.
Yeah. And Susie, to your, I appreciate how down you can feel sometimes about whether we live in a democracy or not. Trey mentioning phone calls and emails, they make a difference. So we should always choose to act, not choose inaction. And I know our MPs may represent us imperfectly, but we need them to understand that there are more Bitcoiners every day, and we will become politically significant before too long. And we are all, the tendency is to be highly motivated. And once they realize that there is a voting block, and that voting block is full of people who are coming up with essentially non-partisan solutions to these problems, then I think we can make a better society for all of us.
I know it takes time, and I know I do get disheartened, and I don't feel we live in a democracy, and I do feel that like they're not listening, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to give up. And, you know, we're still here fighting the good fight, and we will continue to do it even in our low moments.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect place to end this conversation as well. And for folks in the UK, one thing I'll ask as well is, what's the best way for folks to get in contact with you? Maybe folks are listening to this call that are listening to this recording and are in the UK and wanting to know, how can I talk with my local city council? How can I talk with my representative in the UK at a national scale? What's the best way to get in touch with you all and follow along with your work?
Our website is Bitcoin Policy UK, www.bitcoinpolicy.uk. There's a contact form on that website. If you want to contact your MP, then there is a very handy list online. If you just search "Who's my MP" and put in your postcode, that will flag up. And as we refresh and renew our website, we're going to try and include templates for people to use when they want to contact their MPs as well. I'd say Big Brother Watch already have a great template that you can use to contact your MP about central bank digital currencies if you dislike those as much as we do.
That's great. Thank you both so much for this conversation. It was great, albeit if people are like, you guys went all over the place, that was my fault. I let the conversation go there, but I thought every point that you all raised was super, super important, and I really enjoyed the chat. And thank you both so much for all of your contributions. I know so many of us appreciate it. And thank you for this conversation again.